Mike Leonard. He's a federal defense attorney, and Mike told me he wanted to cover three big trials of the summer. So, Mike, hello. And, Mike, you say that these three trials all have something in common, yeah?
Yeah, sometimes trials don't really have the kind of mania, euphoria attached to them as these three do. And the three we want to discuss today are the Mangione case, which didn't end in trial but almost did, the current Lindsey Clancy case, which is just off the charts from a media, social media perspective, and then also the Meta Facebook case, which was a civil case, again, off the charts in terms of the attention focused on it, and then led to a gigantic AG, Attorney General, settlement agreement this week. So all timely, each case has a strong thread to society, to social issues that we think are important, social issues that everyone seems to disagree about.
Yeah. Let's start with the Meta one, because it did happen this week. It concluded this week, and it involves Illinois and a bunch of other states that sued Meta. Walk us through what they were contending.
Yeah, so there's a history to all this litigation. So about a year or so ago, lawyers started bringing claims on behalf of clients against the giant social media companies, Meta, Facebook, YouTube. So then earlier this summer, there was what we call kind of a bellwether trial, which was the first trial against Meta. And essentially, the allegations were an individual plaintiff brought the case, the family of an individual plaintiff, arguing that their daughter, this young woman who was in her teens, was, you know, essentially harmed, suffered extreme emotional distress because of the algorithms inherent in the social media platforms.
Okay.
So as you and I talked about months ago when these cases kind of first came on the scene, it was very analogous to back in the old days, the cases against the cigarette makers, where it wasn't just that, hey, you know, you used a product that could harm me. It was, the idea was that you intentionally knew it could harm me. You intentionally attempted to addict me to this product, in this case, the social media features. And it turned out the evidence in that civil case that went to trial earlier this year showed exactly that they really were targeting 12-year-olds, 13-year-olds, that they had campaigns, they had mechanisms, algorithms to try to bring these people in and to keep them using, as we all kind of knew. And they had actually discussed it internally and how much money they can make by going to lower age groups and all the sort of horrible things you hear about when the curtain's kind of pulled back. So that case, the first civil case in Los Angeles or California, ended in a verdict for that individual plaintiff for a large amount of money, millions of dollars. And of course, it sent off alarm bells that all these social media companies are now going to be subjected to hundreds or thousands of lawsuits. And in between all that, what happened was the attorney generals of a number of states filed their own lawsuit, which very commonly happens. If you have an issue facing consumers generally, the attorney generals across the United States who are elected in their own states they will band together and take on an industry collectively. Gives them a heck of a lot of resources and also the power and leverage to try to leverage a settlement. And as you just mentioned, John, last week, a giant multi-billion-dollar settlement was reached between all those attorney generals of all these various states and Meta and some other social media companies, in which billions of dollars will be paid out.
$18 billion.
And the Illinois will get what share?
$800 million for Illinois.
Yeah.
Now, $18 billion, that's hard to conceptualize. That's roughly a month's worth of revenue for Meta. Some people might hear that and go, well, that's not all that much. That is a lot. I mean, that's a 12th of the revenue for the year. That hurts a company, certainly. Sends a message, hopefully, right?
Yeah. The interesting thing about all these cases is the amazing degree to which the defendant companies can withstand incredible settlements and verdicts in billions of dollars, and it barely nicked them. So I would only disagree in the sense that I think it'll barely nick them. It won't cause much harm to them at all financially. It certainly is a warning shot to them. But I think the most important thing about the AG settlements is I think that's oftentimes a vehicle to drive change. So part of the change will be, you know, restrictions on what features they can use, you know, whether they can target to certain audiences at certain ages, you know. So I think the real benefit is not necessarily the money, because I don't know that you and I and our federal citizens will really feel that benefit. But I think if we can actually bring about substantial change, which I don't know, we can argue about this. I'd like to hear what you think.
Okay.
Can we really bring about substantial change via a settlement that tries to impose restrictions upon social media companies? Is that really realistic and legitimate.
Well, I got a lot of questions and thoughts on this. First of all, I want to get to the addictive principle and part that you were talking about. That, I mean, anyone can use any product in an improper way and be harmed by it. Usually the defense for a company is you didn't use it correctly, right? Like there's warnings, there's things that we have in place for that not to happen. And so often in those cases, the plaintiff doesn't win because they used the product improperly. What lawyers seem to have suggested and backed up with evidence in this case was that the addictive nature of social media was not a bug. It was the feature. It was derived to be that. That's so, because I think a lot of people out there, myself included, a little skeptical, like we're all a little addicted to this thing, you know, but that's on us. Maybe not so much. Experts were saying the science and the algorithms, how it were built, were designed to addict us, right?
Yeah, I think that's a key distinction. Like you said, you can misuse any product. You can use it over and over, et cetera, but there's a difference between sort of the misuse or overuse versus a calculated, intentional, kind of neuroscience-based effort to addict you. And that's really what they proved in these social media cases, which I think is fascinating. And some of the internal communications at the companies where that shows they know exactly what they're doing. They're attempting to target these audiences. They want to get more and more hours out of them. And it's effective. They're tracking this. They're tracking the effectiveness of changes that they make. And it's all based upon a neuroscience foundation, right? It's not just a couple guys in a room saying, hey, let's run more ads, you know? So it's very sophisticated. I think most of us knew that, you know, there's more to social media than just us getting going down a deep, dark black hole,
right,
to watch more videos of some guy jumping off of a cliff, right?
Right.
And so I think that's been exposed, although I think we already knew that was happening. But I guess the bigger question is, can we really drive change from these restrictions that are allegedly going to be put on these companies pursuant to the Attorney General settlement? For example, I heard one of them was the beauty features or beauty enhancements that they market towards and algorithm towards women and young women. You know, that will be somehow limited. But can we really drive change by telling a social media company, you know, we're going to put some ropes around you? You know, is that really going to work? I don't know.
I mean, kids will find their way around anything to get a product that they want to use. That's a tale as old as time. But I think it starts a big social conversation about it and raises awarenesses. And I think that can move the needle a little bit in parents, how they decide how kids use these products, if they're able to control them, and hopefully also reach the teenagers themselves. But teenagers are going to do what teenagers are going to do. I don't think you can 100% prevent it. But if you put up some guardrails and then the teens leap over them, at that point, now I'm not saying I blame the teens for doing it, but now I think the onus is on the individual for using the product improperly.
Yeah, I partially disagree. I mean, one of the big issues that we're not solving is, like, as parents, and I'm one of them, you know, we don't necessarily do a great job of restricting and monitoring our kids' use. We don't, mm-hmm, right? Some families and parents certainly do. I mean, you probably have callers saying, you're crazy, Leonard. I have, my kids are only allowed to do it during these hours. But I think the issue as parents, you know, we still have to take a very active role. And sometimes it seems draconian and it's contrary to what all their friends are doing. And it sort of seems like we're ostracizing them if they can't do what every other kid is doing. But I think that's a part of it, you know, and I think that's part of the solution. But I think just the awareness of the intentionality by the companies of this, hopefully, you know, wakes up parents even more than they were before.
I like your analogy to cigarettes, because I think I understand that analogy, that comparison. Cigarettes were advertised as this great thing. It makes you better as a person. Doctors would be smoking in ads. Well, these companies knew that it was harmful to you and was addictive, and that's what ultimately moved the tide on cigarettes. Here's my question, though. Like, where is this line? Because can alcoholics sue makers and distributors of alcohol who know that their product is addictive? There's so much science on this. They market it as this great gathering spot. They have a little warning at the end of it. But why don't alcoholics sue booze companies if this is the threshold?
It might be coming next year, and you should get Patrick Dolan to bring that class action lawsuit. I guess the only difference is it's from the standpoint of, I don't know if you can point to the master behind the curtain who has that lever he can pull like you can in social media, an algorithm or a neuroscience-based thing. I don't know if you can make the same argument for alcohol. I guess you probably could. But I think in light of the fact we haven't seen that case brought, I don't think we ever will see it brought, but it's an interesting point.
Yeah. Thank you. I think that was a long way of saying, you're right, John. There should be a case for that.
I wouldn't ever say you're right, but I would say maybe I'll cut down on my IPAs and Michelob Ultra consumption. But I can't even say the word.
I've never been more convinced that you drink Michelob than you not being able to correctly say it. Boy, true. Such a down-to-earth Michelob drinker who can't pronounce the name of the beer.
And I just hope there's not a suit against the bourbon makers, because that would wipe me out, too.
So, me, too. Yeah. So I don't want to bring this suit.
I oppose those suits, yes.
Absolutely. Okay, let's talk about, really quickly before we move on, Illinois is going to get $800 million of that settlement. Attorney General Arul says the state was one of the leaders in the lawsuit. His staff has been working on the case for at least 3 years, and he says the majority of the money will go to remediation efforts to try to undo the psychological damage the sites have caused. I don't know what that means. I know other settlements, we've gotten money. Like, you could sign up and get $400 for that one lawsuit years ago. I don't know if this is just going to go to the general fund, but I would like to know what specifically that means in Illinois.
I would. To be honest with you, when I hear that, it sounds like mumbo jumbo. Like, we're going to remediate all the damage they did. I don't think he's suggesting that everyone's going to get a payout. He's not. So, therefore, what really is he talking about? I'd love to know. And I would love to have the AG's office like kind of feet to the fire. Like, what are we doing with this money? Because there's so many great things we can do with it. And I'd love to be able to watch that trail of that $800 million. Like, specifically, where's it going?
Yep.
The public would love to know. And I think generally giving education efforts to kids, like, hey, don't use too much social media. I if that's the remediation we're talking about, I think that's a fool's errand. Sorry.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe it's like a hotline that staff for parents that can call. How do I help out with my kids? Or if your kid is experiencing bullying because of social media, maybe not the direct link that we were talking about, but social media accelerates bullying. Maybe there is some outreach effort or some PS. I don't know. But I think you're right. If it's a few PSAs, then the rest of the money goes into a fund for our debt or something, or to the pensions.
Yeah.
That's a problem to me.
I would love to know, because it is interesting, because we don't usually talk about this, but there's these mass settlements by brought attorney generals throughout the United States. This happens a lot. I mean, it happens every couple of years on a giant social issue. And there really is seemingly no accountability as to where that money goes and whether it has anything to do with the issue that they think that they're trying to attempt to cure or remediate in part. So I would love to hold them to the fire. Maybe we have on the AG in a year on this show, John, and put them to the fire.
Oh, put them to the fire.
Yeah.
Exactly.
They won't come on, but
no.
We can.
We'll do our best.
Mike Leonard, federal defense attorney, breaking down the three trials of the summer. We just did the Meta trial that just ended in a settlement for the states. We're going to talk a little bit about a lot about the Clancy trial in a moment. That's currently in the hands of the jury. But the second one you wanted to talk about, Mike Leonard, was the Mangione trial, right?
Yeah, so Mangione, as you know, is a gentleman who was, deeply troubled, according to the evidence, in terms of emotionally distressed, had mental health issues for a long period of time. The interesting thing about him is that, I think, as a relevant backdrop, he came from a super wealthy family. He had a lot of the things that people don't usually have. However, he also suffered from some serious physical injuries. He had seemingly had some incurable or intractable, back pain issue, right? So he had the constellation of things, and then add to it from a social media factor. He's a good looking guy. Mm-hmm. He's a young guy. He has a compelling presence. So all the things that sometimes add up to public interest in a trial, the TikTok, Instagram world. So he travels, basically in the early morning hours, shoots and kills on the street in cold blood the CEO of this major healthcare company. As you remember, the strange thing about it was there was a huge outcry of support. Nobody knew who the shooter was. Nobody knew why he did it. And before any of that was even known, there was a huge outcry of public support that, gee, we have a lot of issues with our healthcare system. That is appropriate, which I thought was rather bizarre at the time, right?
Yes, I agree.
And then when Mangione was, essentially captured and charged, he was charged in state court and charged in federal court with essentially different versions of the exact same act, okay? And so that led to just a circus of media, because young people kind of galvanized themselves around Mangione as this kind of tragic and heroic figure for taking on healthcare, which to a lot of people seems entirely misguided, right? And so that became kind of the story. You know, healthcare is a problem, and therefore somehow this is appropriate. This vigilantism is appropriate. So on the eve of trial in the state court, he pleads guilty. Of course, admits that he did that. The evidence was sort of overwhelming anyways, right?
Right.
And then with the hope, according to his counsel, that in the federal case, they would go away, drop the charges, and not seek the federal death penalty against him because of the conviction in a state court case. Seems like a strange strategy in the sense that they're separate, you know, sovereigns, essentially, separate systems. So I can be charged, for example, in Illinois, I could do the same act.
Mm-hmm.
I could be charged in state court with state court crimes. I could be charged in federal court with federal court crimes.
Not double jeopardy.
I could go to trial in a state court case. I could get a conviction. I could get a sentence. I could even get a not guilty. And the federal case could go right ahead. And I could get, you know, essentially competing penalties. But why the two groups, state and federal prosecutors, don't often, you know, successively prosecute somebody is because once I get my sentence in the one case, it's going to be taken into account in the next case. So a lot of times it's a waste of time.
Okay.
If a guy gets a life sentence in state court, yes, there's the possibility of death penalty in federal court. And some people would say it's still worthwhile to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Others would say no. But clearly the person's already going to be punished and the next case might not make any difference in terms of the duration of their punishment. If you give someone 100 years or life or 600 years, it doesn't matter if another case comes along and they prosecute you and convict you for that. It's just
a waste
of time.
Might make you feel better, but
yeah, it's a waste of time.
Yes.
So the Mangione case, though, I think why we're interested in talking about this today is the out of the three cases we're talking about, again, this thread of not only a social issue that's important to people, but the social media aspects of people getting involved. And I think both cases, and the third case we'll talk about, all share those weird similarities. And what do you think is it that makes the social media world go crazy about a particular case?
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, why Mangione? Why Lindsey Clancy? Why the Medicaid?
Like, it's relatable.
What is it that... In particular instances, there's a lot of relatable cases, but
a sensational.
Yeah, off the charts, you know, in terms of people's interest in it, talking about it, posting about it, blogging about it, you know, all that sort of stuff. What do you think in this particular case made Mangione a case such a sensation on social media?
Well, because everyone has health insurance and everyone's had a problem with health insurance, right? At some point, you've either been denied, they didn't cover something that you wanted, things cost a lot of money, you're paying premiums. And I think it touched on a national conversation that's been going on for decades, regardless of what happened in that case. So I think that one just touched a nerve of the haves and the have-nots and that whole distinction, right?
Yeah, what I think sad particularly about that case is I don't think it will result in any remediation of that issue,
no.
Right? Like, for instance, in Meta, yes, they're taking steps. They're putting, you know, locks on these social media companies. They're trying to drive change. But I think that the sad part of the Mangione case is I don't think there will be any change driven either legislatively or by the courts.
Yeah,
of the cold blood killing of this guy in the street.
No, there's not it's not like all the CEOs of the health insurance companies got together and said, "Yeah, we should do better for our clients or for our customers." No.
No, there'll be added security, but
exactly.
but there'll
we can
be
do
no
better for our people. But.
Yeah, it's kind of sad when that effort and that emphasis doesn't result in any real change. That's what's sad about it to me, right?
Yeah.
In addition to the death for that guy and his family.
Do we have any inclination as of yet whether the feds will move forward or not with their case?
I would doubt it. I mean, if they're really hell-bent on seeking the federal death penalty, then yes. Typically, they are not. You know, the federal death penalties we've talked about on some of the other programs, which, you know, I moonlight with you, John, is that the federal death penalty is not sought that often. Okay. More recently, this office, this administration, the DOJ under Trump, has markedly increased their efforts to bring the federal death penalty into play. So it wouldn't shock me if they wanted to. I think it would be kind of nothing but a circus show trial. However, if you're in favor of the death penalty, you think that's important, you would think that that's a good use of it.
Mike Leonard already getting texts saying that this Clancy case is open and shut. We'll see if that's how people feel at the end of the conversation. A lot of people hyped up about it. I'm pretty new to it. So, Mike Leonard, give us a little bit, well, a lot of it, about what the Lindsey Clancy murder trial is all about.
The Lindsey Clancy case really is, it's dark. I think it's fascinated the public. It's led to just a massive outpouring on social media, hugely in favor of her, a lot of people against her.
Well, who is she?
Lindsay Clancy is an individual, late 30s in Massachusetts, had a long, successful career as a nurse. By all accounts, she's kind of a wonderful person, you know, great person in the community, great worker, had a great family, had a happy marriage, has two kids, and then she has a third in 2023. And the issue is, you know, first couple of weeks are great and smooth in terms of her, you know, postpartum time. And then for a period of about 4 months, it's just a horrific decline into despair, you know, weight loss, sleeplessness, believing she's going to harm herself, believing she's going to harm her kids, you know, suicidal thoughts, hallucinations, anything you can think of that someone might go through that could be associated with postpartum depression.
And do people around her know she's going through this?
They do. Okay. Yeah. For example, what happens is it's so bad that her husband's aware, her mother's aware, her mother-in-law is aware. So there's times where they come stay with her, you know, to help run the house, run the family. There are multiple occasions where she goes and gets herself admitted by herself for psychiatric care, at least two 5-day stays.
So she's very self-aware of what she's dealing with here.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
it's full-blown postpartum depression and even bordering on psychosis.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So the issue, yeah, is it postpartum depression alone, or is it what's called kind of something that's considered more serious by the courts and by the diagnosers is postpartum psychosis, which is a little different and more heightened, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But everyone can agree, family members, friends, everybody, that she has really gone through horrific changes. She's nothing like the person that she was. She's really in despair in her inability to get help for herself. She's prescribed like 12 different, over 4 months, 12 different of the most serious psychiatric drugs you can have.
Jeez.
She probably sees a dozen different providers, has contact with all sorts of psychiatrists, therapists, you know, and no one's really being, you know, kind of consistent and looking at what did the last guy do? You know, what was the last drugs you're on? You know, how do we change that? And so, it leads up to a really horrific, fateful day where she has a day that's seemingly normal, in the sense that she's in communication with her husband throughout the day. She takes one of the kids to a doctor's visit for a minor health issue, seemingly has a great normal interaction with the doctor, a pediatrician, does activities with the kids that day in terms of building snowmen outside.
Wow.
And then is texting with her husband about ordering like a Mediterranean bowl for dinner. And, you know,
very normal stuff.
Yeah, who's going to pick up dinner? You know, but with the backdrop of 4 months of craziness, right?
Yeah, okay.
And so the husband's not thinking to himself that actually she's having a pretty good day. And then he leaves the house to go to the drugstore in the town to pick up the medication for the one kid who's sick. So the long and short of it, without getting too much detail, is that while the husband's gone, which is, you know, probably half hour, 45 minutes, maybe even less, she kills the three children and she slashes her neck and her wrist and jumps out the window.
Oh my gosh.
And so as a result, not only are the kids are all dead, but she is paralyzed from the waist down for life. So ultimately, after, you know, months of investigating and looking into and all this and knowing all the medical history, they still decide to charge her with three counts of first degree murder, arguing that she does not have the appropriately high level of postpartum psychosis, and actually arguing, even in their opening statement, that all her acts were intentional, planned, that really there was nothing wrong with her, you know, which is real stretch for a jury. And so this case has gone to trial over the last 6 weeks. And as you've noticed, as you've been at the gym working out or getting your Mediterranean bowl, John,
right.
That this case, I think, has really captured the public's attention nationally and also internationally. But
It comes at a time when we're having much better conversations about postpartum depression, not shying away from talking about it. A lot of women are sharing their journeys. And finally, I think a lot of people are listening to that conversation, right? And I just want to also note that while men can also get postpartum depression, it does not affect men as much as it does women. We are two guys talking about this, so maybe our knowledge of it is a little more limited. But I think we're both aware of the fact that this has been part of the national conversation now for years about trying to raise the awareness of this.
Oh, incredible. I was actually having a discussion with somebody who's a younger person in their 20s. And we're talking about the case because it seems like everyone wants to talk about the case if you're a lawyer. And she was making the point that in the 1950s, her grandmother was suffering from something very similar to this after giving birth to one of the kids. And back then, which, you know, arguably not that long ago, they labeled her hysterical and gave her, you know, some kind of lobotomy type treatment, which is unbelievable.
It's crazy.
And so we, you know, where we've advanced, if we've advanced at all, this trial really put at the forefront, you know, postpartum depression. But this other heightened diagnosis, which is called postpartum psychosis, which, you know, allegedly to meet your burden of proof as a defendant to show that you had it, you want to be able to show things like hallucinations, inability to control your thoughts, inability to control your actions, which from my standpoint, you know, the evidence was pretty uniform that over that 4 month period of time, she was exactly that.
Yeah, this is a tough one, and I'm not trying to show sympathy for the DA or the prosecuting attorneys, because it's a tough one. I mean, you have three babies that are dead, and there's a lot of people upset about that, of course, naturally so. But you don't want to seem completely out of touch with the modern reality and the reality of what this, disease is probably not the right word, condition is. There's a lot of people to back up the fact that she was on a bunch of different medications. She herself was checking herself into, she wasn't battling this silently. It seemed like a very well-known thing. Is some of the evidence pointing to the things on that day that maybe lead some people to believe that she was not as bad as maybe some of the diagnoses were? You mentioned all the normal things that were happening on that day. Is the prosecutor saying, look, she obviously was in a troubled state, but look at all these very normal things she was able to do. How then does she make this very abnormal decision and claim it's psychosis when she did all these normal things during the day?
Yeah, John, you're spot on. I mean, that's from the prosecutor's standpoint, there's really only one case you can present. You can't deny that over a long period of time, she was extremely troubled and was nothing like the person that she was. And it's impossible to rebut that because of all the psychiatrists, even their own, right?
Yeah.
However.
Oh, even the prosecutor's own?
Correct. Yeah. But however, what they're trying to do is thread that needle and say, look, she had postpartum depression, clearly. She had all these issues. However, we don't believe it rose to the level of postpartum psychosis. And therefore, according to the prosecutor's argument and theory, she could control her actions and she understood the nature of her actions. Therefore, she was not insane at the time that she committed the crime. And you make a great point. Of course, from a prosecutor's perspective, what you do is you break down that day and you say, hey, look, you know, everything was great. Every person that she interacted with, including her husband, including the pediatrician, including people at the restaurant, you know, whatever, everything seemed normal. But however, you know, that's a very skin deep analysis,
well,
right?
This goes two ways. I could see so many people saying out there, look, you can hold both these thoughts at the same time. Postpartum depression is a very serious thing. It's a real thing. It's something that people should be more sympathetic for. We should get more research on and find more effective ways to help women through this incredibly difficult part of their life. However, the vast majority of people with postpartum depression don't kill their kids.
And sure.
So, but also on the flip side, you could also say you could have postpartum psychosis and be in a completely deranged mental state. Deranged is probably not the appropriate word, but you understand what I'm trying to say, trying to be sensitive, and still present for a few hours as if everything's A-okay. It doesn't remove you from that state. I imagine experts have said, and I haven't followed it, that postpartum psychosis isn't something that is 24/7 on your brain the whole time and you can't function as a human, that like many mental health disorders, you can kind of go in and out or reason or rationalize your way through a day as a human can. And then there's flashes, bursts of this incredibly intense moments. Right.
Yeah. I think that's consistent with the testimony too. So this idea that everything's black and white and we can break down the day and we can figure out intentionality and understanding of conduct and, you know, what she thought because, you know, portions of the day seem so normal. But for 4 months, of course, portions of the day were normal and she was absolutely underwater.
Yeah, you could probably pick other days that, she had the Mediterranean Bowl. She talked about that.
Yeah.
Obviously, it didn't end like that day. That's what we're talking about, this day for a reason.
It's very typical in a case in which insanity is raised, okay? Because what you want to do for the prosecutors is point to conduct that shows that you really do know what you're doing and particularly if a prosecutor can point to something that shows intentionality from the standpoint of planning and preparation. So their big argument, which, you know, some jurors might find persuasive, is like, look, we believe that she took steps to remove the husband from the home, right? To get him out of there. And then, you know, she did the crime while he wasn't there, correct? And so their theory of the case and their sell to the jury is that that was all a calculated effort by her to be able to carry out what she wanted to do and understood it. The flip side to that, of course, is we could argue for miles, for hours of why, of course, you know, she's a deeply troubled individual and could have no control over her conduct.
Boy, but you bring up a great point, right? Like if someone, if you could show that her behavior on that day, while seemingly front-facing normal, was actually part of a calculated plan that she had hatched, and she's able to execute said plan, that no longer sounds like quote-unquote insanity. That sounds like someone who knows the difference between right and wrong. And while she was clearly in some sort of altered state, generally speaking, someone that plans methodically, if they're able to show that and the jurors agree, I could see why someone would vote guilty for murder in that case.
Yeah, the interesting thing is even the facts that I just, you know, relayed to you, you know, they still show, they really just show a gap in time in a day of like a half hour, right? They don't, there's nothing that would show any sort of meticulous planning or forethought other than the fact that he wasn't there at the time and that's when it occurred.
Okay.
So it's a real tough one. And I think the reality is that, okay, so if she's found not guilty by reason of insanity, what it means for her life is that she will be institutionalized. And she will be subject to review by court to see if she has returned to sanity. And actually, we're involved with a case in DuPage County that is has the same type of issues for a killing that occurred, you know, 15 years ago or so. But it doesn't mean she'll be back out. Okay. First of all, she's paralyzed for life.
Yeah.
She lost her children. She has, you know, great public shame and
all
that.
Of course.
However, in addition to that, she would go to a psychiatric hospital and they would have to, you would have to have a hearing at some point to show, to prove through expert testimony primarily, that she has been restored to sanity, that she can be released to live in the public, possibly with the restrictions, that she's not sufficiently a danger to others or herself that she could be released. So it's not like she's going to walk out the courthouse door.
Right.
But if the prosecution wins and the jury rejects the idea of insanity, then she'll basically get a life in prison sentence, but the judge, you know, might look at it differently.
The jury is in deliberations.
What would your prediction be, knowing what you know? I mean, you don't know anything about the makeup of the jury, but knowing the facts.
Not guilty by reason of insanity.
I think so, too. I would be surprised if it went the other way. I would be really surprised.
I could see the sympathetic side of it. Mike Leonard, you're a federal defense attorney. You know this stuff in and out. How can people reach you?
312-380-6559. Leonard Trial Lawyers. We represent individuals in state and federal criminal prosecutions or people who are being investigated. And we also represent whistleblowers. And John, the students who are accused of academic and other misconduct, we defend them in their proceedings at universities and colleges across the country.